Chapter 45. Yuki stepped away from the jury box filled with a tremendous, soaring feeling. She had delivered the best opening statement of her life. No regrets. No wish for a redo. She'd done good. As soon as she was reseated at her counsel table, Judge Rathburn said,
Mr. Giftos, is the defense ready to make their opening statement?
James Giftos stood up, looking as straight and sharp as a knife. He responded to the judge, saying,
No, Your Honor. We reserve the right to make our statement at a later time.
Okay, then, said Rathburn. Ms. Castellano, please introduce your first witness.
Yuki was surprised by Giftos's decision. He was leaving her version of Mark Christopher's Night from Hell story uncontested in the jury's mind until he put on his case. Normally, that would be a risky, even reckless move. But Giftos wasn't reckless. He had a plan. What was it?
Ms. Castellano,
the judge said.
Yes, Your Honor. The people call Officer Phyllis Chase.
The bailiff opened the heavy wooden door at the front of the room, and Officer Chase, wearing khaki pants and a blue blazer, sporting a choppy blonde haircut, entered the room and strode up the aisle. She was sworn in at the witness stand, and after she'd taken her seat, Yuki approached her. Yuki had had a good feeling about this sex crimes cop from the first time she met her. She was absolutely professional and confident. She was a perfect witness. Yuki elicited preliminary information from Chase, where she worked and when she'd received Mark Christopher's call saying that he had been sexually assaulted.
Please go on, Yuki said.
My partner, Officer Al Martinez, and I invited Mr. Christopher down to the station and took his statement.
Yuki asked the officer a series of questions about the interview, and Chase answered that she had observed fading bruises on Mr. Christopher's wrists and ankles that appeared to be ligature marks. Photos had been taken, and after that, Chase and Martinez had accompanied Mr. Christopher to his apartment, where he showed them the clock that was also a low-tech recording device. Yuki guided Officer Chase through her testimony that the recorder and the video had been reviewed by the techs at the SFPD, that Ms. Hill had been brought in for questioning. Chase said,
She denied that a rape had taken place. She said the sex was consensual. We showed the recording to the DA's office and then we arrested Ms. Hill and logged in her S&W 38 caliber handgun.
Brianna Hill put her folded arms down on the defense table, lowered her head, and began sobbing softly. Yuki showed the photographs of Mark Christopher's faded bruises to Chase, who said,
Yep, I took those photos.
Yuki passed the photos to the jury foreman, and then, after entering them into evidence, she thanked Officer Chase for her testimony.
Your witness,
Yuki said to James Giftos. Giftos had his arm around his client's shaking shoulders, and he spoke from his seat.
No questions, he said.
Of course Giftos had no questions. Chase was unimpeachable. Yuki was thinking ahead to her next witness when Rathburn called for a recess.
We will resume at 2. Don't be late, he said.
Chapter 46. James Giftos's arm was still wrapped around Brianna Hill's shoulders as they left the courtroom together. Yuki, walking not far behind them with Arthur, thought that Brianna Hill looked pitiable, like her heart was breaking, and Yuki didn't doubt that it was. When she decided to rape Mark Christopher, maybe on impulse, she couldn't have imagined that it was going to lead to this, a trial where she would be exposed in every sense of the word, with a possibility of going to prison for as long as 8 years. Yuki shook her head as she walked with Art along the marble-lined hallway. Arthur said,
What's wrong?
I was feeling sorry for Brianna. Don't tell anyone.
Trust me, I won't. And with all due respect, she doesn't deserve it.
Yuki, you're giving voice to sexual crimes against men. Personally, I appreciate it.
Thanks, Art.
Art said that he was going to head for the men's room and would meet her in the lobby. Yuki pulled out her phone to call Parisi when James Giftos was suddenly right in her face.
Yuki.
James.
Your opening statement was a little wooden, but not terrible.
Actually, the jury looked quite moved, she said.
Don't get your hopes up, he said. I've watched you blow up several cases God knows you should have won. Alfred Brinkley, mass murderer, not guilty. Junie Moon, killer, not fucking guilty. Then, of course, more recently, another mass murderer, this one world-class and acting as his own attorney. Hey, I was there. I saw him take your case apart like he was playing pickup sticks. He wasn't even a lawyer. You know, most people would have gone into a different line of work after a disaster like that.
Yuki snapped. Don't you get tired of yourself, James? Don't you want to run home and take a shower? Because you really stink.
She was 10 yards from the elevator bank and on the move, having to weave through and around clumps of attorneys and court workers clogging the hallway, while trying to fend off James's jiu-jitsu attacks on her morale. Meanwhile, he tagged right along with her.
I'll be honest with you, Yuki, Gifto said.
I'm sure of that, she said.
You have a real weakness when it comes to running the sword through. You just roll over and show your own underbelly.
Shit. How could he see through her like that?
Say what you like. Think what you will, she said,
attempting to push past the aggressive jerk. He stuck with her all the way to the elevator.
What more can I say? I think you're a nice girl, but you're a loser.
Brianna Hill came out of the ladies' room into the corridor. She called out to Giftos and he called back,
I'm coming.
To Yuki, he said,
You should really go back to that pro bono law firm. What is it called? The Defense League?
Yuki stopped walking and Giftos stopped too. He towered above her. She stared up at him and said,
Sounds to me like my opening really freaked you out, James. You're showing your own underbelly, you know. And I will run the sword through.
Sure you will. Be careful not to cut yourself.
James Giftos was laughing as he turned and walked back to his client. Chapter 47. Arthur Barron questioned the prosecution's next witness, Frank Pilotti, the SFPD's IT specialist who testified that the video recording had not been altered. James Giftos had no questions for Pilotti, and he also had no challenges for the prosecution's next witness, a seasoned psychologist and author who had well-established credentials in the emotional effects of rape on the victim. And then Yuki called Paul Yates to the stand. From the first moment, Yates twitched, sweat, and was pretty much a steaming hot mess. Responding to Yuki's questions, Yates replied that he worked at the ad shop as a copywriter, that when his creative group shot a commercial, Brianna Hill, as head of production, was in charge. Yuki asked,
Did you ever have a social relationship with the defendant?
I wouldn't call it a relationship. We went out once.
Please tell the court about that date, Mr. Yates.
He sighed, then said,
I took Brianna to a Chinese restaurant after work. It wasn't a fancy place. She seemed to like me. We weren't far from my apartment. I asked her, Do you want to come back to my place and hang out for a while? I thought she'd say no way. She said sure.
Please go on, Yates said.
We started making out on my couch, but I felt like it was all happening too fast. I didn't know her very well. I started thinking what it would mean to have sex with her and how I would handle that at the office. I was in my head too much. I didn't think I could do it if I tried. So I kind of patted her back and told her, Sorry, no offense or anything, I have an early morning meeting.
How did she take that?
She got mad. She leapt off the couch in a huff, and when I looked up, she had pulled her gun out of her purse. She dropped her purse and showed me her other hand. It was clenched, like this.
Giftos shouted,
Sidebar, Your Honor.
Approach, said Rathburn, waving them in toward the bench. When both legal teams were standing before him, Giftos said in a voice thrumming with barely controlled anger,
Judge Rathburn, evidence of an uncharged crime is prejudicial and should not be allowed.
Ms. Castellano?
Your Honor, Mr. Yates didn't go to the police out of fear of retribution by the defendant. but his testimony about the gun shows her pattern of abuse. The jurors have a right to hear what the witness has to say.
Rathburn asked,
You deposed the witness, Mr. Giftos?
He wasn't forthcoming.
Well, I think this is a question of weight versus admissibility. I'm going to allow the testimony, Mr. Giftos. It's admissible, and you can cross-examine as to its weight.
When James Giftos returned to his counsel table, his face was stormy. Yuki remained standing near the witness box, keeping her elation under wraps. She'd won the very valuable point, the admission of Paul Yates's testimony. But she'd also seen that Yates was high-strung. Even now, he looked ready to bolt for the exit. She asked him if he needed to take a short break.
No, I'm okay.
Yuki nodded and asked,
Do you remember what you were feeling when the defendant pointed her gun at you?
Terror, said Yates. Stark terror. It was the most frightening thing I've ever experienced. I froze. I could hardly hear what she was saying. My mind was jumping all over the place. The phone, the door. Pop her in the face with my fist. Was she jerking my chain or was she totally psycho? Fuck, I didn't know what to do. She told me to take off my pants. At the moment, that seemed like the best thing to do.
Did you take off your pants, Mr. Yates?
I dropped them to the floor.
What did the defendant say to you, Mr. Yates?
She said something like, We're going to, you know, fuck. And then she opened her hand and showed me the two blue pills. It was Viagra. She told me to take the pills. I said, sure. And as she held them out, I took a chance and batted her gun away. When she went after it, I pulled up my pants and ran out the door.
And what happened after that? Yuki asked.
I went down to the basement, where I stayed until I thought it was safe to come out.
Paul, is the woman who assaulted you in this courtroom?
Yes, he said.
Please point her out for the jury.
For the first time since he'd taken the stand, Paul Yates looked at the defense table. He pointed to Brianna Hill.
Yuki said, Let the record show that the witness has indicated the defendant.
The judge said,
The record will so reflect.
Thank you, Mr. Yates. Your witness,
Yuki said to James Giftos. Chapter 48 Giftos stood, buttoning his jacket. He kept his eyes on Paul Yates as he crossed the courtroom's polished wood floor. Giftos greeted him, then launched into preliminary questions about his work as an advertising copywriter. Yates described his job.
I write ads and campaigns, print and TV commercials, etc.
Do you do other kinds of writing other than advertising?
You mean for myself?
That's right, said Giftos. Do you write poetry? You know, creative writing.
I've written some screenplays, Yates said tentatively.
So, fiction. You'd call yourself, in fact, many people would call you a creative person. Isn't that right?
I haven't sold any of my scripts.
Well, maybe your luck will change. Mr. Yates, the events you just described taking place in your apartment. You said that you and Ms. Hill were making out and you stopped the action.
That's right.
Giftos stood close to the witness without blocking the juror's view. He said,
And your testimony is that she pulled a gun. You were terrified. Is that correct?
Yates straightened his posture and answered,
Yes.
Did that really happen, Mr. Yates? Or did you make this all up once you heard the fantastic story Mr. Christopher spread around?
No, sir, not at all.
Giftos said,
Is this one of your creative ideas? Trying it out for your next script?
Yuki jumped to her feet.
Objection. Counsel is badgering the witness.
Rathburn said,
Sustained. Don't do that, Mr. Giftos. Do you understand me?
Unruffled, Giftos said,
Sorry, Your Honor. I'll rephrase. Mr. Yates, is it true that Ms. Hill pulled a gun on you?
Absolutely.
Giftos walked back to his table. Ms. Benson, his second chair, handed him a manila envelope, and Giftos brought it back with him to the witness stand. He said,
"You said you were really scared of that gun, Mr. Yates. Is that right?"
"Yes."
"You must have been staring at it the whole time it was pointed at you,"
said Giftos.
"I'll bet you'd say it was etched in your memory, right?"
"I guess it was,"
Yates said. Giftos asked,
"What kind of gun was it, Mr. Yates?"
"A 38 caliber Smith & Wesson."
"Very good. It's common knowledge that's the type of gun Ms. Hill carried, right?"
"I guess."
Giftos said,
"Mr. Yates, what I'm going to do is show you pictures of various handguns. Please point out the 38 caliber Smith & Wesson, the type of gun that you've testified Ms. Hill used to terrify you."
Giftos started slapping 8x10 photos down on the arm of the witness stand, one after the other, and asking,
"Like this one? How about this one, Mr. Yates? Was it like this one? This?"
Yuki watched as Giftos worried Yates like he was a dog with a bone.
"Is it this? This? This?"
Paul Yates shook his head, saying,
"I don't know. Maybe. I don't think so."
"No."
Giftos picked up the last photo of a handgun that Yates had dismissed and turned it over.
"Will you please read the notation on the back of this photograph?"
Yates said,
"This isn't fair."
"Your Honor,"
Giftos said to the judge,
"the witness will read the caption."
Yates glanced down, then turned his eyes back to James Giftos, saying,
"It says that it's a Smith & Wesson 38 caliber handgun."
Giftos gathered the photos together, handed them to Yuki, and said,
"Let the record show that the witness failed to identify the gun of the type he testified was used in his terrifying encounter with the defendant."
Yuki glanced through the photos, then handed them back to Giftos, and he entered them into evidence. Just when Yuki thought Giftos was going to say that he had no more questions, he turned back to Yates and said,
"One more thing, Mr. Yates. When you decided to come forward with this story, did you check out the statutes? Do you understand that perjury is a crime?"
Yuki objected. Paul Yates looked like he'd been punched. Rathburn said,
"Sustained, and I want that stricken from the record."
"Withdrawn. I'm done with this witness,"
Giftos said, turning his back, again returning to the counsel table. Once seated, he took the defendant's hand.
Judge Rathburn said, "Mr. Yates, you are excused."
Chapter 49. 12 hours had passed since an unarmed, middle-aged woman was shot dead on Geary Street for no apparent reason. Conklin and I were thinking about the victim as we faced each other across our desks that morning, trying to get a handle on the why, in the hope that it would lead to a who. Why? She hadn't been robbed. She hadn't put up a fight. She'd simply been shot to death at close range. Who did it? We had no witnesses, no forensics, no motive, no videotape, and it wasn't our case. But we did have our CI, Millie Cushing, the most productive confidential informant with whom I'd ever had the pleasure of working. Millie had called me last night within minutes of the murder, and it was her call that had sent me and my partner out into the night.
"It's the same pattern, Lindsay,"
Millie had said.
"It's another execution. Lou was homeless. She frequented Union Square. Someone is trying to rub us out,"
Millie said, before her voice melted into sobs. "Millie, does Lou have a last name?"
"I don't know it."
And then she hung up. Dressed for work with a gun, a weatherproof jacket, and sturdy shoes, I kissed my family goodbye. Conklin was waiting for me outside his apartment in the rain and the dark, and we sped off to 77 Geary with lights and sirens. The first units on the scene had taped off a small perimeter, and Conklin and I took charge of it as we waited for the red carpet to be rolled out for Moran and Stevens, or anyone in Central's homicide unit. When my patience ran out, I radioed Central Dispatch to report, "No investigators are on the scene. It's raining. CSI has to get here fast." We waited a total of 2 hours and 15 minutes, and because I had called it in, the ME's van and CSI mobile arrived. It's basic crime scene procedure that homicide investigators have to see the scene before the body is moved. So we all waited. When they finally showed, I greeted Garth Stevens at the door to his vehicle. I said, "I took crowd photos and called CSI. He said,
"I guess you're going to win the Wonder Woman of the Year award."
"What's wrong with you?" I asked him. He opened his car door, and I stepped away and watched him and Moran mosey over to the dead body. No rush. The shooter was long gone, and so were the witnesses. Stevens had all the time in the world. I was raging as I drove Conklin home, and then lay awake most of the night, aggravated to obsession because of those two freaking cops from Central. When I woke up this morning, I was still obsessing, and I had a throbbing headache. I left Joe asleep in bed, and I took care of the best baby girl in the whole wide world until Joe was on his feet. Then I gulped aspirin with unadulterated caffeine and flew out the front door like Wonder Woman. So I was in a state of high anxiety as I sat across from Conklin at our ancient gray desks. I downloaded the photos from my phone and spun my monitor around so Conklin could see my nighttime panorama of the crowd, banked 3 deep opposite the Geary Street crime scene. The next shots on my chip were of the dead woman, ID'd by Millie as Lou, currently known as Lou Doe. She was slumped against a brick wall, 2 bullet holes punched through her poncho, glistening in the rain. I switched back to the crowd shots. "Maybe someone saw something and will say something," I said, looking at the spectators' faces.
"Push in on the faces," Conklin said.
I zoomed in on the onlookers, whose faces had been caught in mid-expression by my flash. Many of their eyes were shaded by their umbrellas or raincoat hoods. I'd sent this bleak lineup to CSI last night. Maybe facial recognition software would hit on a known criminal. Wouldn't that be amazing? World peace would also be amazing, but I had no control over that. I said to my partner, "I'm going to take this to Brady. Again."
"Look," he said, "in case there's any doubt in your mind, I want you to go after Stevens and Moran. I'm with you all the way."
"I didn't doubt that for a second," I said. Chapter 50. I looked across the squad room, over the heads of homicide cops at their desks, to Brady's glass-walled corner office. A visitor sat across from him with his back to me. "Who's he with?" I asked Conklin. "Wait, it's Jacoby. That's even better."
"Wait until he's gone, why don't you?"
"I'm walking the plank," I said. "I can't help myself."
"I'll come too," said Conklin.
I said, "You should probably stay here and man the lifeboat."
"Watch yourself," said Conklin.
I knew full well that if Brady got involved in Central's string of unsolved homicides, there could be an interdepartmental squabble that would be unpleasant for him. I hated to put pressure on Brady, but I had to do something about a very bad situation that was getting worse. I'd already crossed Central's line in the sand, and had dragged my partner over it, too. With good reason. A spree killer was executing people unimpeded, and no one seemed eager, willing, or able to stop him from killing again. How did an interdepartmental squabble stack up to that? I walked down the bullpen's center aisle and knocked on Brady's glass door. I didn't wait for an invitation. Jacoby stood up when I entered the small office, saying,
"Hey, Boxer, how you doing? I'm just leaving."
"Please stay," I said. "I want to talk with you both." Jacoby sat back down. I was washed over with love for him. For all the years on stakeouts together, the night when we'd both almost died of gunshot wounds in an alley, the days when he'd reported to me and we'd exchanged offices and I'd reported to him. I remembered a perfectly beachy day when he'd stood in for my father and given me away to Joe. My feelings for Brady were also strong. We'd stood shoulder to shoulder under fire, and I'd witnessed his remarkable bravery and strong leadership many times, When we weren't on duty, he was Yuki's husband and my good friend. But in this situation that I'd created, there was a chain of command. And between the three of us, I was the lowest link. I took the chair closest to the door and said, "Sorry to crash your meeting, but there was another homeless killing last night."
"That woman on Geary," said Jacoby. "What do you know about it?"
Brady sighed, leaned back in his chair.
"Go ahead, Boxer. Tell him."
I said, "Let me back up a little ways, Jacoby. Chief." I started with Millie Cushing, the woman who had tagged me outside the hall a few weeks ago to tell me about the murder of a homeless man near Walton Square. I followed that up with a brief rundown of the shooting of another vagrant on Pier 45. It took Central's investigators, Stevens and Moran, nearly 2 hours to arrive. During that time, the scene was corrupted by passersby, and witnesses evaporated. I've checked. There are no suspects on either the Walton Square or the Pier 45 killing. My CI believes that there is a serial killer putting down the homeless. I agree with her. Jacoby said,
"She's homeless too?"
I said, "That's right," and went on. Conklin and I went to the Geary Street scene, and as before, we had to take charge. "It's a pattern, Chief. This is the third homeless killing that we know about, and my CI says there are more. She says that cops stroll in after the scene degrades, and witnesses and suspects have taken off without a trace. I say it looks like this killer is on a roll." I took a breath. Jacoby was looking at me fondly, but Brady was annoyed, and he showed it.
"Boxer, are you done?"
"That was the short version," I said.
"I'm not going to Lieutenant Levant to complain that it took his guys 2 hours to arrive at a crime scene," Brady said. "No good will come of it, I promise you that."
Jacoby said,
"Is that what you want to do, Boxer? Go to Levant? How about if Levant complains to Brady that you're interfering in his crime scenes? How would that play out?"
"We have to do something," I said, louder than I intended. Brady said,
"Jesus Christ." "Drop it, Lindsay," Jacoby said. "I know that that's not what you want to hear, but listen to yourself. Levant is going to call this politics, and it will sure look like it."
"Are you kidding, Jacoby? You think I'm political? Me?"
"No, I said how it's going to look."
I couldn't stop myself now. "So you're saying I should drop this and mind my own business?" Jacoby said,
"I'm sorry to come down on you like this, but we're your friends. Think what Levant is going to say and do."
Then he stood up and said to Brady,
"This is Lindsay when she gets her stubborn on."
He turned to me.
"Not to pile on, Boxer, but you look pale. Are you okay?"
I glared at him. "I feel fucking wonderful. Can't you tell?" I took a deep breath. "I'm going to file a report with Internal Affairs." Brenda Fergosi, our squad's assistant, was outside Brady's door, either to see what the hell was going on or to bring news to Brady. Either way, I was blocking Jacoby's exit. I left the office. Nobody tried to stop me. Chapter 51. Hours after my dust-up with Brady and Jacoby, Conklin and I huddled with Millie Cushing inside Interview 2. She was our only key to the murders of three people. Conklin was meeting her for the first time, and he made the right impression. He found a blueberry donut in the break room, fixed her coffee the way she liked it, and adjusted the thermostat to her preferred temperature. Millie beamed at him, enjoying the attention. Then she answered his questions.
"I have 2 grown-up kids. My life didn't turn out exactly as planned, but I have no complaints. I help out at some of the shelters, and they help me out, too. I met Lou at the Columbus Avenue shelter."
Millie looked good. Her blondish-grayish hair was fluffed, and her turtleneck and sweater and trousers all looked laundered. I told our CI that this meeting was being taped for the record, and that Conklin and I were fighting to insert ourselves into a case that was out of our jurisdiction. Conklin said,
"It would help if we knew more about Lou, like what her movements were just before she was killed. First thing we've got to know is if someone had a beef against her or if she witnessed a crime."
"You know I want to help, But if I start asking too many questions...
She didn't have to finish the sentence.
Got it, said Conklin. We don't want you to put yourself in danger.
I was thinking that if this were our case, we would take Lou's picture to homeless shelters, ask around, do the job of detective work. I bit down on a sigh, then said, Millie, I took pictures of the crowd of onlookers on Geary last night. They're pretty grainy, and the light was terrible. But will you take a look at the printouts and see if anyone seems familiar? I put the envelope on the table. Millie dug into her bag and pulled out her reading glasses. Then she moved the photos to her and began a close examination of the crowd. While she was absorbed, I scrutinized my informant. I had searched her name on the internet and our own databases, and had found nothing on her, not a driver's license or an address or a warrant for her arrest. I supposed that without a computer or a car or a house or a criminal history, there was little record of a life. She'd told Richie that she had grown kids, but not where they lived. Cushing wasn't a common name, but it wasn't one of a kind either. It was possible that Millie Cushing wasn't even her name.
I don't recognize anyone in this photo, she said,
shuffling it to the bottom of the stack. I watched her look over the second photo, and it seemed to me that her eyes snagged on one of the faces in the crowd. You know someone in that picture? I asked.
No. I thought I did for a second, but no.
You're sure?
Yep. Sure as can be.
Millie looked through the remainder of the enlargements and returned them to me, saying,
I don't see many street people in that crowd. Everyone's wearing nice clothes, umbrellas, hats. They look like solid citizens, every one of them.
We thanked Millie, and while Rich was walking her out, I pulled out the second photo from the group, the one that had caused Millie to give it a second look. This section of onlookers was standing behind the tape, three rows deep. I counted 14 men, 6 women in the shot. All were wearing hats or hoods, or holding up umbrellas. I peered at each face, looking for what? A guilty expression? A crazed grin? Or maybe one of those faces would jog my memory. I'd seen all of those people in real life. Had one of them said or done anything that I could have noticed at the time and forgotten? And then, something kicked in. One of the men did stand out in the crowd. He was in the back row at the end of the line wearing a black knit cap. He looked angry. He could have been justifiably pissed off that there had been a shooting. Or maybe he hadn't liked my phone flashing in his face. Or hell, could be that the umbrella beside him was dripping water down his neck. Or something else. Like maybe that there were cops at his murder scene. I memorized his face and the 19 others in that photo, while waiting for forensics to run the whole batch of maybe 60 people through facial recognition. Drilling in on faces, that was something I could do. Chapter 52. Back at my desk, I got Charlie Clapper on the line. Clapper is head of our forensics lab, a former LAPD homicide cop and a real law enforcement treasure. No pleasantries were exchanged or required.
I got back the DNA on the coat Conklin found in the trash near Pier 45.
Good. And?
There was DNA on it, all right. It's been fondled, worn, or slept in by innumerable people, making the tests useless. Like a bedspread from a $30-a-night motel.
Yahoo, I said.
On to the next, said Clapper. Facial recognition didn't give us a hit on any of the faces in your crowd shots, Boxer, but it was a good try.
Thanks for pricking my balloon, I said. What about the ballistics?
That's more interesting, Clapper said. The rounds in Laura Russell matched those in Jimmy Dolan, the deceased from the Sidney G. Walton area 4 weeks ago.
So? Same shooter, I said.
Same gun was used, he said, but it's a cold hit.
A cold hit. Bullets matched each other but didn't match any gun on record. I thanked Clapper, told him that there was a new body at the ME's office, a Jane Doe, and likely another couple of rounds would be coming to the lab today. I just had to make it happen. Conklin was on the phone with the Columbus Avenue shelter. I signaled to him that I was going down to the ME's office, then I split. I took the fire stairs to the lobby, ditched out the back door, trotted down the breezeway to the office, and pulled open the glass doors. The receptionist was Gregory, the latest in a long list of people who averaged about 3 months behind Claire's reception desk before the grimness and tedium of the job drove them to greener pastures. After the face-off Greg and I had on his first day, we'd reached an understanding. Claire was never too busy to see me, and Greg no longer went bureaucratic when I showed up. I said, "Greg, I have to see Claire." About 11 people sitting in the reception area, cops, ADAs, family of the deceased, gave me the evil eye. Honestly, I couldn't blame them. Greg said, "Dr. Washburn is on the phone." "I'll just be a minute," I said, "or less." Greg pressed the buzzer to the inner sanctum. I pulled on the handle, walked down the short gray corridor, and found Claire in her office on the phone. She gestured for me to sit down, and I did. After a minute, she hung up and pulled a file out of a desk drawer. "I'm going to take a wild guess you're here about the Geary Street victim, even though your name isn't on the case file." "Never mind." "Let's hear it," I said. "As you know, there was no ID on the victim's body, and so far there have been no inquiries about a victim who looks like her. It's early yet. Someone could miss her in another couple of days, and I have room to keep her for a little longer." Claire opened the folder and read to me from her findings. "Manner of death, homicide. Cause of death, 2 9-millimeter rounds, one to the heart, the other to the left lung, only a few inches away from the first. The shooter came in close. Gunpowder on her rain slicker shows that he or she was no more than 2 feet away."
"I'm wondering, did he know her?"
I mused out loud.
"The post showed that she was in poor health. Arterial plaque, fatty liver, diabetes, lungs full of tar. I reckon she was in her late 40s, but her organs tell a story of neglect and bad habits. Anyway, she was killed by lead to her heart."
"What was in her shopping bags?" I asked.
"Soda cans, a soiled blanket, dirty clothes."
"Clapper is waiting for the rounds. If someone comes looking for her, call me, okay?"
"Will do.
You okay, Linz?"
"Never better," I said. I leaned across her desk and kissed my best friend goodbye. Chapter 53. I was early for my 4:30 meeting with Internal Affairs Lieutenant Johnny Hun, upstairs on the 5th floor. I knew of Hun, but we'd never met. IAD was opaque, the most secretive department in the SFPD. Neither Brady nor Jacoby had tried to stop me, and now I was flying blind on my own. I sat in the reception area and flipped through a left-behind copy of the Chronicle while getting my fractured thoughts in order. I had a realization. Ever since Jacoby had told me that I looked like crap, I'd been feeling that way too. According to my loose waistband, I'd lost weight. My holster was at the tightest setting and still felt uncomfortably loose. And the headache I'd had this morning was back and had brought its younger brother. Was I putting myself under too much pressure? Was I becoming a nervous wreck? Before I could follow this thought, a gray-haired man of about 50 entered the room and spoke my name. I stood up, saying, "That's me."
"I'm Johnny Hun," he said.
We shook hands. I followed the IAD lieutenant to his office and sat in the chair across from his desk. The room was devoid of personality. White walls, plain wooden desk, some framed certificates on the wall. No photos or personal items. The lieutenant was all business. He said,
"I got a call from Chief Jacoby. He speaks very highly of you, Sergeant."
"We've been through the wars together."
"So he said. He was vague about why you wanted to see IAD. Why don't you lay out the issue for me?"
I told him that I had come to register a complaint about 2 homicide investigators from Central Station, giving an almost verbatim recitation of what I'd told Jacoby and Brady this morning. A tipster had called my attention to killings of homeless people that had not been solved by Central Station's Sergeant Stevens and Inspector Moran, who appeared to be working the cases with an utter lack of urgency. I told Hun what I knew about the dead poet at Walton Square, and about my own experience with Stevens and Moran at the Pier 45 and Geary Street murder scenes. I said, I accessed whatever information I could find, Lieutenant. I have Stevens's report on the three crimes, all in progress, and I've also gathered up the reports I filed and an autopsy report on Laura Russell, the Pier 45 victim from the ME. I reached across the desk and handed him a folder.
So, what are you saying exactly, Sergeant? You think Stevens and Moran are gold-bricking?
Something like that. Maybe they're padding their overtime, I don't know. But I do know that they don't seem too eager to nail a serial killer who may be executing vagrants and planning to continue his spree.
Han nodded, said, Do you have any evidence that Stevens and Moran are dragging their feet or scamming the system or committing a crime?
Lieutenant, what could be a legitimate motive for letting these homicides slide?
So, what I'm hearing is that you have nothing but unsubstantiated theory. They could be working feverishly behind the scenes, and may even be following a suspect or a lead, and you wouldn't know that, would you?
I said, they keep telling me to bug off. Why? I may have seen something. I may have a theory.
Could they suspect a political motive? That 850 Bryant is trying to put Central out of the homicide business?
Maybe, I said, but they'd be wrong. I care about the unworked homicides. I care about a killer who hasn't been caught.
Okay, I'll accept that. And how would you have reacted if Stevens and Moran had shown up at your crime scene?
I thought about that. I didn't like the image. Hun said,
Sergeant Boxer, you're taking this case to heart. I know a little about you, and what I know tells me that you're a very good cop. So let's just keep this quiet. Let it play out a little longer. I'll keep my ear to the ground. If I decide to launch an investigation, I'll let your lieutenant know. If you learn something I should know, call me. Now I have another meeting, he said, getting to his feet. I'll show you out.
Feeling awkwardly dismissed again, I thanked Hun, shook his hand, and took the fire stairs down to homicide. Conklin had left for the day. I left too, got into my car and drove home. I was still obsessing, having conversations in my head with Hun, Jacoby, and Brady, all at once and one at a time. As in real life, the talking was getting me nowhere. Chapter 54. Yuki hadn't spoken with Mark Christopher since Giftos's scathing cross-examination of Paul Yates, and she was worried. How would Mark stand up under Giftos's scorched earth style? She had called Mark and suggested that they meet once more before his upcoming testimony. He'd said,
Let me take you out to dinner. You deserve it, and I would rather have this chat over Osobuco.
Now she was waiting for him at Mancini's, a popular after-work Italian restaurant in the financial district. She hadn't been here before and now took in the pleasant ambiance of the place, with its clean lines, brick walls, and cove lighting. Mark had called to say that he was running late because of traffic. Yuki sipped ice water and answered email, and when she looked up, the maitre d' was leading Mark to the table. He apologized for his lateness, bent to kiss her cheek, and sat down beside her. Mark had always appeared boyish, but he looked younger still this evening. He wore a baby blue sweater under his blazer. His hair had recently been cut, and his long lashes and dimples completed the look of youthful innocence. Over drinks and Fritto Misto, Mark said, I can't quite believe this trial is for real. It's like I'm watching a movie about someone else's life. Online, on TV, everywhere, people are talking about me. What happened, what I said and did. This very personal thing that happened to me is both virtual and hyper-real. Yuki understood Mark's inside and outside perspective. His future turned on a verdict by strangers. He would be vindicated. Or, if the jury went with the defense, Mark would be branded a liar for the rest of his life. She said to Mark,
You read the transcript. What are your thoughts on Paul's testimony in Giftos's cross?
I found Paul completely credible, Mark said. I could see exactly how it happened. He was scared. He ran. I commend him for slapping the gun out of Brianna's hand. If I'd done that...
What about Giftos's cross-examination?
Well, as I read it, it was pure hell for Paul. His testimony was honest, but when it came to the gun identification, he choked. I don't know if I could identify her gun either.
Yuki said, It was a smooth move by the defense. Not probative, and yet Giftos got it in.
Mark shook his head. Then he said defiantly, Giftos can't shake me. I know what happened.
It was brave talk. Did he mean it? Or was he talking tough to himself? Yuki had never seen him looking so vulnerable. She felt for him, and she wondered again what was wrong with Brianna. Was she a predator who had never been called out before? Or had she, like untold numbers of men in top jobs, taken her executive position at the agency as licensed to be sexually abusive? After a long pause, Mark asked,
Do you think Brianna is going to testify?
Yuki said, It's generally not a good idea to put the defendant on the stand. But in this case, I think she has to speak to the jury. If she does, I'll be ready for her.
There was no point telling Mark what she was thinking. After Mark gave his testimony, Giftos was going to do his damnedest to gut him. Chapter 55 Mark went silent and stared at his wine glass. Yuki wondered if he was worried about what Brianna would say on the stand. More likely, he was worried about his own performance. He looked scared. She reached over and patted his hand.
You did a perfect job when you testified to the grand jury. You can do this, she said.
Mark's trance was broken, and he gave her a direct, confident gaze.
I know. We can do this.
She was glad that she had persuaded Red Dog to let her try this case. If she won, Mark would be vindicated. Men who'd been sexually assaulted would be more free to say so and to pursue justice in the courts. Dinner arrived, and it was delicious. She had duck breast. He had braised short ribs. She and Mark went off topic and for the first time didn't strategize about the trial. Yuki told him about the break she had taken from the DA's office and what it was like to come back.
Exhilarating, she said with a smile.
He confided that he was in line for Brianna Hill's job.
I've been told off the record that it's mine if I want it, Mark said. I don't think that would look or feel good. I'll probably go to another agency when this is over. Maybe I'll relocate. To another country.
They each had a second glass of wine, but when the waiter came to take a dessert and coffee order, Yuki said,
No thanks.
Mark asked for the check, and Yuki said,
Are you sure, Mark? I can expense this.
But he handed his card to the waiter and said to Yuki,
I'll give you a ride home, okay?
I drove, she said.
Then I'll walk you to your car.
Yuki's Acura was parked on California. Mark kept to the street side of the sidewalk, and when the car was in sight, he reached across her shoulders to straighten the collar of her coat. Yuki looked up at him, and then his arm was around her and pulling her close to him.
You have no idea how much I like you, he said.
Yuki demurred, but Mark lowered his face and came in for a kiss. She was shocked and offended, and she pushed him away, saying, Hey, Mark, no! He released his hold and tried to laugh it off.
I'm sorry. I'm just nothing but wide-open feelings right now. I have no defenses at all.
That's not good, she said.
I'm really sorry. I didn't plan that. It was an impulse.
She said, I have to get home. We'll talk tomorrow.
Yuki walked on ahead, unlocked her car, and after buckling in, gunned her engine. She drove up California without looking into her rearview mirror and turned north onto the straightaway of Sansom. Those last minutes with Mark had really thrown her and changed her feelings and her perspective on him. She was thinking now that his invitation to go out for dinner rather than meet in her office had been calculated. That in fact he had planned this, or something like it. Mark's boyishness, the charm, this was his stock in trade. It was easy to imagine him as a flirt, or as a rape victim. She thought back on the recording she'd seen so many times, which showed him being violated by Brianna Hill. James Giftos had said that the recording started while the sex was already in progress. His theory of the case, Brianna's version, was that Mark had staged a rape game. Was that true? Did Giftos know something that she didn't know? Was that why he had put off his opening statement until she'd presented her case? Yuki's phone rang. It was resting in the cup holder in the console beside her. She picked up. Mark said,
Yuki, please forgive me, okay? I was inappropriate and I'm embarrassed. I won't do that again.
Okay, Mark. All is forgiven. Good night.
She clicked off and dropped the phone back into the cup holder. For the first time since she'd met Mark Christopher, Yuki had a sense of foreboding, like she had entered a tunnel and a bright light filled her vision. Like a train wreck was looming, directly ahead. Chapter 56. Michael was loitering with purpose on the Embarcadero near the ferry building when he spotted her almost by chance. Was it her? He'd been wrong before. His eyes locked on her features, and he felt a contraction, a tightness that started in his groin and shot up the center of his body to his throat. It was as if he were zipped up. The older woman was accompanied by an animated, stoop-shouldered younger man who gestured expansively as he talked. He had the look of a junkie transported by the rush of a meth high. The woman laughed. She was enjoying his company. She was dressed appropriately for a walk through the fog on a chilly night. Her coat was old but looked sturdy. She had a canvas carry-all slung over her shoulder, and on her head she wore a knit cloche hat in several shades of green. The pair of weirdos was on the move, taking a leisurely stroll. Michael fixated on her familiar, rolling gait as she and her piece-of-shit companion continued past him. He waited until they'd covered 25 paces, about 2 car lengths, then followed the couple as they cleared the smattering of pedestrians around the ferry building, crossed the street, and turned onto Mission, one of the main arteries through the South of Market neighborhood. The traffic was sparse after 9 p.m. A wind blew through the canyon of office buildings, what Michael thought of as Wall Street by the Bay. He jammed his hands into his new, well-used thrift shop coat and gripped the gun butt with his gloved hand. It felt good, like a handshake with a friend. Up ahead, the woman and her companion stopped under a streetlight and embraced, before the round-shouldered man crossed the street and the woman continued walking along Mission, crossing Spear. Michael kept his eyes on her while humming a made-up tune to the cadence of her unhurried walk. And then, almost as if he had willed it, she stopped and reached into her bag, poked around inside it, and pulled out a wrapped sandwich. She was busy, intent on removing the clinging wrapper, her body limned in the glow of the streetlights. And not another soul was on that sidewalk. They were alone. Michael closed the gap between them and called out her name. She looked up, watched him pull the gun from his pocket and pointed at her. She looked into his face and almost smiled. No fear. That pissed him off. I thought it was you, she said, holding her sandwich.
Well, Michael said,
for once you're right.
Any last words?
God help you, she said. Chapter 57. Michael felt that his gun was an extension of his arm. He squeezed the trigger. The gun cracked, the bullet thudded into her chest, and his arm thrummed with the shock. He was electrified with a thrill that was monumentally more satisfying than what he'd felt the other times he'd fired his gun. He watched all of it, committed every minute move to memory. She screamed, dropped the sandwich, and clapped her chest with her hand. She sucked in her breath and stared into his eyes. He read her expression. Disappointment. That was good. It was how he'd felt his whole life.
Have some more, he said. He fired again and she dropped, falling sideways, disillusionment frozen on her face. She was the picture of eternal sadness, but she was still alive. She wheezed and looked up at him. She tried to speak, but nothing could be more irrelevant to him than her words. She'd told him so many times, it's not what you say that counts, it's what you do. He pumped 3 more rounds into her, watching her jerk and twitch with each shot until he put the final bullet in her head. At last, she lay still on the sidewalk. She was dead. Dead. He wanted to take a moment to do a war dance, to scream out his relief and pleasure, to revel in the pure ecstasy of the best moment of his life. But he'd promised himself that night while he was standing in the rain on Geary, as the police cars screamed up to the body, that he would make no more mistakes. He knew what to do. He scooped up the shell casings, chasing one into the gutter, then clutching them in his fist, he walked quickly 2 blocks southwest to the intersection at Beale. There, a small paved plaza filled a niche between 2 office buildings. It was an arty little space, organized with a grid of small trees standing in concrete planters. 2 people were in the plaza. A man sat on the edge of a planter, his head bent as he spoke into his phone. A woman leaned against a building wall, smoking a cigarette, maybe waiting for someone or just deep in thought. Michael spotted the trash can between 2 planters and walked nonchalantly toward it. It took only seconds to stuff the coat and gloves into the black plastic bag lining the can, and to transfer the gun and spent shells to the pocket of the black jacket that he wore under the coat. He left the plaza, disappearing into the fog and shadow on Mission. What a wonderful night. What a wonderful fucking night. If he missed her at all, it was because now he had to find another target. And he had an idea who that would be. That bitch who'd taken his picture on Geary. Sergeant Lindsay Boxer, he remembered. She was like his mother, shaming him for drinking milk from the carton, for taking a few bills from her purse, for his magazines, shaming him in front of his sister, their neighbors, his own friends. And Sergeant Boxer had done the same with the flash of her camera, exposing him, nailing him there on the street. She would have to pay for that. Chapter 58. While the dishwasher hummed and sloshed, Joe and I folded laundry at the kitchen table. I was on autopilot. My hands turned the jumble of shirts and towels into warm cotton packets, but I was thinking of other things. Among them was my mother's Limoges vase, which Julie had pulled off a table, smashing it into ungluable shards. I also kept rerunning my cringeworthy meeting with IAD's Hun, and the cherry on top was that I was weak and headachy, a little bit queasy. It was an overall sick feeling that was becoming harder to ignore. Joe said,
"That's it? No woo-hoo?"
"Oh, geez, Joe, sorry. Say it again, please." He said,
"I got a call from the new head of anti-terrorism at the Port of San Francisco."
"Wow. About a job?" Joe said,
"Yep. There's a new guy, Benjamin Rollins, ex-Marine. He's looking for a hands-on risk assessment pro, freelance or on staff, to be decided. He's known to be kind of a dick, but I think I'd like him."
I said, "He's kind of a dick, but otherwise fantastic?"
"Correct," said Joe. "This isn't about love. It's about money."
3 cheers for money. Joe cheered. I laughed and we went back to folding. Actually, this breaking news was fantastic. Joe was healing well from his injuries. It wouldn't be long before Julie would be going to preschool and Joe needed a job. Even though my thoughts were scattered, I could focus on that. I said, "So what's the next step?" Joe was telling me about the interview with Security Director Rollins next week when, of course, the phone rang. It was a weeknight, and to me that meant I was still on duty. I took the phone out of my jeans pocket and glanced at the caller ID. Joe watched me and shook his head no.
Brady, I said into the phone. What's wrong?
He jumped right into it.
A homeless woman was